I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Connor Cyrus. This month is projected to be one of the worst months of the pandemic yet when it comes to new infections of COVID-19. And officials say, thanks to the Omicron variant, it's likely to get worse before it gets better. That's obviously not the news we were hoping to hear during yesterday's weekly press conference from the governor. Now, that prognosis from health officials is a major reason the Agency of Education announced significant changes to how schools will handle the pandemic going forward. The state health and education officials say they're hopeful the new guidance and changes to how students are tested and who's considered a close contact will help slow the spread of the very contagious Omicron variant. The new guidance no longer requires PCR surveillance testing, and they're changing how contact tracing is done. To help explain these new changes, the science and reasoning, I welcome Vermont Secretary of Education Dan French to the show. Secretary French, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Good afternoon.
And I also welcome State Epidemiologist Patsy Kelso. Patsy Kelso, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, you can join the conversation with Secretary French and Epidemiologist Patsy Kelso. What questions do you have about the changing guidance? Where would you like to see more clarity? You can join the conversation 1-800-639-2211. You can send an email to vermontedition@vpr.org or tweet us at Vermont Edition. Now, Secretary French, I want to start with you. As I mentioned earlier, your agency and health officials say they're changing how schools contact trace and how they're no longer doing surveillance testing. Let's start with the basics. Can you explain what the changes are and why your agency had to pivot so fast?
Yeah, sure. Just to sort of put it in context, throughout the pandemic, we've essentially had three strategies that we use to manage the pandemic in schools. One being vaccination, two being contact tracing and testing, and three being the mitigation recommendations that we provide to schools. Of course, this year, vaccination by far and away the most important strategy of the three. Contact tracing and testing is a function of both the public health function, but also of the operational aspects. And in particular, contact tracing, we've been identifying as a logistical consideration and concern, largely through the Delta surge. That it's a very labor-intensive process. And a lot of the processes around contact tracing and testing have fallen on our school nurses. So we've heard that loud and clear from them that they were struggling in the context of heightened counts as a result of Delta. And then we implemented Test to Stay, which I think was very successful in terms of keeping more students in school, but here too also added to the logistical burden of nurses. So we had this challenge, an acute challenge facing us coming into the holidays around logistical and operational considerations. And then more recently, Dr. Kelso and her team, concluding that the efficacy of contact tracing and testing in particular, surveillance testing, which is a slower sort of a response, if you will, was going to be inadequate to the rising case counts of Omicron. So once those two pieces came together, really necessitated us to make a fairly quick shift. And that's what we did on Friday, was to announce that shift was coming. We are very much in the process of delineating out the specifics of that right now as we speak.
Epidemiologist Patsy Kelso, the state and the CDC have done a really good job at training Vermonters to follow the science. What's the science behind the changes Secretary French just laid out?
Thanks for that question. It's an important one. The science tells us that the Omicron variant of COVID-19 spreads more easily. And we've all gotten used to the definition of close contact being spending 15 minutes or more within 6 feet of someone. And the reality is Omicron spreads more easily than that. And I think we're going to see that definition of close contact potentially changed in the future. Omicron also has a shorter incubation period, which means the time from when you're exposed to when you become infectious is quicker. So it means that we need to be more responsive in a quicker way. And taking the time to do contact tracing which when you think about it, when you step back, someone needs to have a specimen collected. It's either a rapid test and they get their result right away, or the specimen needs to go to a lab and come back in a couple days. Then the health department needs to hear about that positive result, needs to reach out to the person who got the specimen collected and let them know that they're positive and provide guidance, and then do the contact tracing process, which is calculate your infectious period based on when your symptoms started or when you got your specimen collected. Think about who you were with during the time you were infectious and which of those people would be considered a close contact, and then start the process of reaching out to all those close contacts to notify them. The reality is Omicron doesn't give us the time to do that type of a response.
I think a lot of people, epidemiologist Patsy Kelso, were confused about the focus on testing the unvaccinated. What's the science behind testing people who are unvaccinated versus testing everybody who's both vaccinated and unvaccinated?
We know that the vaccines are very effective in preventing infection as well as severe illness and hospitalization and death. They're not 100% effective. So while they can prevent infection in a lot of people, they don't always prevent infection. That means it's most important to focus on the unvaccinated people because they're more likely to become infected themselves and be able to infect other people. But in fully vaccinated people can do that as well. It's less likely, but it can happen. So the focus needs to be on the not fully vaccinated people, while also paying some attention to even people who are fully vaccinated.
Because it's
less a matter of
after
protecting them because they're
told that there was a close contact.
It's a matter of preventing.
Yeah, you know, just to recap, you know, we're in the process of putting this out in the form of our formal recommendations and guidance. So what we did on Friday was sort of outline this process, and this is just the beginning of us becoming more specific on how we're going to approach it. To Dr. Kelso's point, there is emphasis on symptomatic individuals and the unvaccinated. So essentially, that's the big fork in the road, and it does pivot or sort of reside and rely on that new definition of isolation and quarantine that we've developed and sort of coming from the CDC change as well. So in schools, the classic scenario, again, is that a student becomes symptomatic in the sense of the nurse, so to speak. And, you know, one of our goals was to get school nurses sort of back into sort of their typical clinical role as opposed to being part of this larger apparatus of administering the public health requirements. But in their clinical role, they would test the student. We will provide testing available to nurses to do that administration on site in schools. If the student's positive, they'll be sent home. If they're vaccinated, they'll be receiving that advice relative to quarantine and isolation for vaccinated individuals. Unvaccinated individuals will be receiving the advice that they should, it's recommended that they swing by and pick up test kits to get them through 5 days of administering those tests at home. That's a big distinction. Assuming those tests come are negative each day, they would be allowed to continue to participate in school. So, from my perspective, a couple things going on. One is nurses sort of getting back into that process where they're dealing directly, I'll say from a clinical perspective, with their patients, the students. But also the schools acting more as a distribution site for the test as opposed to having the responsibility of administering the test on site, though nurses still will have some tests available to do that sort of screening that I just described. But also then shifting some responsibility for the administration of the screening tests in particular to parents at home. And part of the larger strategy here is that, we'll see a broader distribution of these antigen tests in the public. And sort of to that theme that Dr. Kelso mentioned, the idea of being more responsive and staying apace with the speed of Omicron, we feel that distributing these tests more broadly in the public will allow us to enable people who are making the decisions around their safety and so forth to act more quickly. And ultimately, that additional deployment of testing and that ability to make quicker decisions will ensure the broader health of everyone.
I just want to clarify something. If a student is vaccinated and positive, they will be sent home?
That's correct.
And they'll be given a test kit just like students who are unvaccinated.
if you're positive, you have to follow the isolation and quarantine, in this case, the isolation instructions per our guidance, which is to stay home until your symptoms are gone. And then at the end of 5 days, we recommend you take a test to confirm that you're through the disease.
I'm curious, we heard from a lot of parents who were upset and confused, and I think they want just as much clarity as all the journalists do. How can parents have confidence that their kids will be safe in the school cafeteria if Omicron is more contagious and it's more likely to spread during lunch?
Yeah, these are great questions. And I think, and I invite Dr. Kelso to comment as well, but part of the shift here from my perspective is that, when we started sort of our experience with COVID, and particularly our experience with COVID in schools, our first approach was to protect the perimeter of the school, if you will, to keep COVID out of the school, and then also to stop it spreading from within the school. And we know from our experience last year, for example, the surveillance testing in schools that were administered every week, that schools were arguably very safe relative to the broader contagion patterns that were happening in their communities. So, our thinking has evolved to a certain extent, and the virus has evolved as well. We now have community spread happening more broadly in our society, and schools are no longer able to maintain that sort of perimeter. And we've always seen that what happens in schools is more or less a reflection of what goes on in the community. So the idea of somehow the lunchroom being a less safe environment, I don't think we've ever seen that necessarily. In our epi data, we certainly have constructed recommendations around making those environments where there's larger numbers of students present to be more safe. But that really hasn't shown up in our data as being an area of concern.
Epidemiologist Patsy Kelso, do you agree? Is that how we're following the science?
I do agree. The reality is we've seen cases that we think were transmitted in school settings, but we don't think that that's tied to the lunchroom. We think it's just the fact that this virus spreads from one person to another. And the reality is kids need to be in school, and they also need to eat during the day. So, given the fact that we're not seeing cases that we think are spread in the lunchroom, as opposed to just in the classroom setting or in gym or in other activities in school, we need to do the best we can, but kids need to be in school.
Now, we have a social studies teacher, Eric, who teaches at Lemuel Union High School, and he asks, the new policy says any student who was in the class with another student is considered a close contact. And all close contacts will be given antigen tests to test for 5 days. This means one positive case in the class of 20 students would require nearly 100 antigen tests. For a high school student that changes classes multiple times a day, it could mean one positive case could require hundreds of test kits. What happens when a student is considered a close contact but can't obtain a test? What if schools cannot obtain enough tests to carry out this program? Will these schools be required to close?
I can start that. Firstly, I just draw a distinction again between vaccinated and unvaccinated. And certainly, it's important to acknowledge the supply aspects of this decision making. And supply, I would argue, has always been a significant consideration throughout our planning. But in what that teacher just described, we first draw the distinction between vaccinated and unvaccinated students. So vaccinated students would not be supplied with 5 days worth of tests. So we know in high schools in particular, vaccine's been available for a longer period of time. And I think statewide, though it's not equally distributed, we suspect over 75% of our high school students are vaccinated. So vaccinated students in that scenario would not be needing 5 days worth of tests. They would be recommended on the fifth day that they get a test to return and so forth to confirm that they're through the illness. But our focus on, in terms of distributing the test kits, would be on the remaining unvaccinated students. So that's a smaller number of students.
And what about, and again, I think to the students, what about daycare centers and these younger population of students who aren't vaccinated?
Yeah, it's an important consideration. And a lot of our planning before the holiday was, still thinking on expanding test to stay in particular. And we had made an expansion shift already to include the public pre-K sites because they were already inside the buildings of the public schools. And our planning was shifting to expand access to the antigen test in daycare centers and the private daycare centers. And that planning is still moving forward, and that announcement, I think, has been made. So we are definitely focused on that area, and it's important that the testing be available. I think on the other end of that, some of those students, I think we would qualify as being less vulnerable to the virus. So in terms of risk, that also factors into our decision making. But it's been in our plan all along to expand the testing supply. And that's something I think we recently announced that we were able to do.
And epidemiologist Patsy Kelso, when it comes to supply, how is the state doing in obtaining things like these antigen tests that will get sent home to unvaccinated students who test a positive or are considered a close contact?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's something that we're actively working on. We wouldn't have rolled this out unless we thought that we had the supply to get this program going. But we're going to have to really pay attention as we roll this out and see just how many tests we're using, making sure we have more available to back those up as they get used up. I want to go back to the scenario Eric described. Secretary French is correct that the unvaccinated students will be provided with 5 tests that they could take home and do at home each day. The fully vaccinated students will also be offered 2 antigen tests. These are the same rapid take-home tests, because we do recommend that in fully vaccinated people, when they do have an exposure, they go ahead and get a test around day 5. So we'll be also providing some take-home tests for fully vaccinated people and recommending they use those in a few days.
Secretary French, when do you see schools up and running on these new guidelines?
Yeah, that's a great question. What we put out to schools yesterday is that it's largely predicated on supply, obviously, and those shipments should be coming in at the end of this week. So end of this week, early next week, I think we'll see schools starting to shift over to the new approach. But it is largely driven by supply at this point. As Dr. Kessler mentioned, we wouldn't have made this shift if we didn't have confidence in supply. But a lot of these decisions do boil down to logistics. So I would expect most likely many more schools you'll see flipping over to the new approach early next week.
Now, the state has roughly 80,000 students. What does supply look like to maintain this program in the state?
Yeah, it's a good question. We're starting out now with just our projections on what's available and so forth. Part of the answer to that, and I think Dr. Kelso alluded to that, is going to be based on ultimately what the uptake is, and certainly what happens in terms of the patterns of contagion with the virus. But at this point, and I think I heard the president signal he's going to provide additional support at the federal level for schools as well. Right now, we have plans to secure that supply based on some approximate modeling that we're doing in schools. But really, the definitive answer to your question will be based on what the experience is and the pattern of contagion that we see with the virus.
So what's the bare minimum in terms of what the projections are?
Yeah, I don't have that number at my fingertips. It's something we do with the modeling with the Agency of Human Services. But we, hundreds of thousands of kits are being deployed to the state. I think, before the holiday, with Test to Stay, we were doing, I think, approximately 26,000 tests in a day, in a week. So we have some rough idea of what we're going to be looking at. But, right now, our modeling is pointing to having sufficient supply initially. And we have additional supplies coming in. But some of what we'll be modeling will be based on the experience, the actual live experience of schools as they deploy the new system.
Now, before we return to our conversation, I want to share something Health Commissioner Dr. Mark Levine shared in the governor's media press briefing yesterday.
Lots of people are going to get Omicron. Talking now in terms of not if, but when. It doesn't mean, though, you're going to become deathly ill.
Now, this is not the first time we've heard this idea that the rapid spread of Omicron means many, many more people will get sick. Epidemiologist Patsy Kelso, if a lot of people are going to get COVID, how do you keep parents and teachers and the public engaged in proactive measures like testing and masking?
I guess the same way we keep, all of Vermonters. They've been engaged with the governor's guidance and the health department guidance all along. We need to keep them engaged by keep telling them what we know, what we think is coming, and making recommendations that are realistic that they can follow. I think, Dr. Levine also said it's going to be a bumpy next 4 weeks or so. But the good news is, with the speed with which Omicron spreads, I think it is going to be a shorter surge. We thought the Delta surge was going to be pretty time limited and then drop right off, and it didn't do that. But the fact that Omicron is so much more transmissible means it is, burning through populations more quickly. And all the forecasts say that, 6 weeks or so, and it should start to decline. So it's going to be bumpy, but we hope Vermonters stick with the plans and keep following the guidance, and then we can get out on the other side.
Now, I'm hearing from state and national health experts that are saying it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when people get Omicron. I'm wondering, do people still need to be safe when it comes to this? If it's inevitable that we're going to get it, should people, I guess, try to get it safely?
Well, I think the thing everyone should do is get vaccinated, because if you're fully vaccinated and fully protected with a booster, the likelihood of getting severe illness is very, very low. And the data suggests that Omicron does produce milder illness. That doesn't mean it's safe if you're not vaccinated. But it does mean being vaccinated is highly protective. And then we've also been asking Vermonters to think about the most vulnerable person in their lives, whether it's a grandparent or someone undergoing treatment for cancer. Think about that person and needing to protect them. So they might or might not be able to be vaccinated, but if you can, that's something you can do to protect those vulnerable people.
Listeners, you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to the phones to Heidi in Ripton. Heidi, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. Hello?
Yes. What's your question or comment for epidemiologist Patsy Kelso and or Secretary Dan French?
Well, my question is, with these vaccine mandates that are going to be coming down for children, and I just think that they're a population that is kind of being overlooked right now, in that the likelihood of them getting sick from this COVID, I mean, seriously ill, we were just talking about severe illnesses. They're not a population that's like that, yet we're locking them down and we're demanding that they get a vaccine, which is proven to, I can't go to whether the vaccine itself has proven to reduce illness in people. I don't think that's proven. I haven't seen a study on that yet, but the fact that they can get this virus and they can clear it without a vaccine should, and the health, I mean, the mental health of these children wearing their masks.
Heidi, let's get to your question, please.
My question is, why are we doing this to our kids? That's my question. The elderly are...
Thank you, Heidi. Let's take that to Patsy Kelso.
Yeah, I'm not hearing discussion of vaccine mandates. We are strongly encouraging Vermonters who are eligible for the vaccine to be vaccinated, but it's not a requirement.
Secretary French, what would it take for the state to see a statewide COVID-19 vaccine mandate?
Yeah, there is. Firstly, I'd point out there's a formal. We're not mandating vaccines currently. There is a formal statutory mechanism by which that's done. It's called an Immunization Advisory Council. Dr. Levine, in his role as Commissioner of Health, sort of leads that conversation. As Secretary of Education, I have a seat on that council. Dr. Levine and I had an informal conversation, as we've had on and off, about this topic and when the advisory or the immunization council should meet. At this point, our thinking was, and we had this conversation before the holidays, that we might not convene it sooner than May, that kind of timeline, because again, there to a certain extent, there's no urgency on this topic, you know, relative to the vaccines having full approval and so forth. But where there is a formal process by which this is evaluated, certainly relies heavily on the formal recommendations from the public health experts. But that's not on the front burner right now, and it's something we'll probably take a look at later in the spring.
So, would you push for Vermont to require COVID-19 vaccines for kids in the fall?
I'd certainly like to hear that conversation play out among our experts and the scientific folks that really are following these things very closely. I think, you know, the evidence is accumulating. But again, it's the point I would just convey on this. It's not something that's on the front burner. It's something we'll probably take up later this spring.
I guess my question is, if we know that vaccines and health experts say that this is what's right, what's your hesitation in taking a strong stance now?
You know, I'm not a public health expert, but certainly the idea that the vaccines, to a large extent, don't have full approval yet, I think is important to acknowledge. And also, just as, you know, consuming a lot of information to watch what other municipalities and states are working on. I don't see this, many places are not moving very quickly on this topic yet. So that, for me, points to the need that this process is happening as it should in a very deliberative and thoughtful way. And again, in Vermont, we have a process for that. It doesn't require a new process. And it's not something that's, you know, immediately on our front burner, so to speak, in terms of our planning.
Let's go to Jen in Essex Junction. Jen, welcome to Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment for Dr. Patsy Kelso and Secretary of Education Dan French?
Thanks for having me, Connor. I first want to say that I'm an elementary school teacher currently at home with COVID that I likely picked up last week when I returned to school. And which is why I can tune into this program. Otherwise, I would be in the classroom with my students. And my question is I'm wondering, Secretary French, like how much conversation did you have around the possibility of maybe schools need more staff to accurately do the testing? Like our nurses are totally burdened. That's true. But to, like in my mind, the answer to that would be to send EMTs to the school to do the testing in the morning, to train more school personnel to do the contact tracing. And we've taken what is really a structural problem and put that into the hands of individual families to resolve. And I think we're making a lot of assumptions about Vermont families, about all Vermont families, that they would, you know, be home in the mornings to do the testing or be willing to do the testing at home or be willing to report, you know, accurately the results of the tests of their students.
Secretary French, a lot of questions there. Let's start with training, I guess, outside school officials to come in and do the testing. Let's start there.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it kind of brings us back to where we were in the fall, particularly as we were implementing Test to Stay. You know, we had, as we acknowledged, difficulty keeping up with contact tracing as a result of Delta, and nurses, school nurses, felt the strain of that immediately. You know, there was no real way to add capacity in that regard. As Test to Stay came on, we saw districts, let's say, innovate in that regard, because there's elements of Test to Stay that are, I'll say, purely logistical and don't necessarily require a clinician to administer. But the bottom line is there just aren't additional people out there. To the questioner's point about EMTs, we have EMTs working in vaccination clinics, working in hospitals. We have everyone, all hands on deck in school districts as well. So the systems, I think, are fully staffed as best they can in terms of logistics. But again, what sort of made us really start to focus and move more quickly in the last week or so was not only are these systems logistically challenging, but then once we conclude they're also not efficacious, that really requires us to reevaluate them and make a shift. So, there's no simple answers to the logistics in terms of staffing. And I will say that is, you know, to your point earlier about the number of cases, I think, you know, Vermonters should be prepared in addition to keeping themselves safe, but also be prepared for logistical things to, shut down. I mean, particularly, I think we'll see more school closures in the coming weeks as a result of staff availability issues than we saw earlier in the pandemic. And that's going to create more tension in families and so forth. But, you know, I think we just we need to be patient working through, as Dr. Levine said, this is going to be a bumpy ride in the next couple of weeks. Everyone just needs to be patient, work together as we try to work together and get through this.
Now, when it comes to staffing, I want to go to let's go back to the phones, and I want to go to Rutland Town, where we have Jack. Jack, welcome to Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, I'm wondering what the thanks for having me. I'm wondering what the incentive is for parents who still won't vaccinate their children, and how we are giving them daily tests, and we're requiring responsible parents who vaccinate their children to have take-home tests and do all of that. And what is the administration's stance on an incentive to vaccinate children who are eligible?
Jack, I think we got it. I guess let's take this to, let's start with Secretary French, and then we'll go to Patsy Kelso. Secretary French, what incentives are being done to incentivize parents to get their students vaccinated?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think the previous questioner asked a similar sort of approach. You know, how do we get at this issue of getting people to cooperate in the process and so forth? And it's a very real issue. I think, you know, to the issue of incentivizing vaccination, first thing is we do is really make it as easy as possible for people to have access to vaccines. And, you know, we've put that together by using school clinics and state-run clinics and other settings and so forth. And we have a lot of volunteers involved in that effort. I think in particularly with the 5 through 11 vaccination, we had the strong participation of our pediatrician community. So in terms of, it's not necessarily an incentive, but to certainly encourage parents, if they have reservations, to talk directly with their healthcare provider and get that information directly from someone who not only is familiar with the science, but also is familiar with their family circumstances. But ultimately, we, as we have throughout the pandemic, we just need people to do the right thing. And I think a key ingredient on this piece, which is, I think, the thread between the two questions, is like, well, how do we know parents parents who aren't interested in getting their children vaccinated are now suddenly going to be administering these test kits? We don't necessarily know that. But what's going to happen in this new system is that we're now more broadly dispersing these kits out into society and into families. So yes, there will be those kinds of instances, but now we're going to have testing more widely distributed. So in the balance, in the net, if you will, we'll have better surveillance and better information, more rapid information for ultimately parents to make more decisions if they are inclined to do so. And those that don't want to follow the testing, we still encourage them and recommend that they follow the isolation and quarantine guidance that we've promulgated.
So speaking of surveillance testing, we did get an email from Mary, and she says, as a public school staff member, I have been relying on surveillance testing to protect vulnerable family members. What kind of testing will be available to fully vaccinated school staff, and how often? Does one have to be symptomatic to qualify?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's one I've heard immediately as I was socializing our pivot in this guidance with Vermont NEA and our other stakeholder groups. You know, to the point earlier, firstly, I would draw a distinction between PCR testing and surveillance testing because, you know, the PCR platform is still a very much useful platform for us. Surveillance testing, on the other hand, as you heard Dr. Kelso say, this idea of a regular scheduled test, which, you know, you get the results 2 days later, and it basically tells us at the moment you took the test, you were not positive, doesn't really hold up with the speed of Omicron. So it's not useful to the individual necessarily and to other decision makers. So the replacement, and I think the pivot here, is the antigen tests, which provide more rapid results. We're also going to be deploying more of what we call LAMP tests, which are confirmable tests, I would say comparable to PCR at schools, that will provide also more or less immediate results. So the specific question about vaccinated staff, to what extent they'd have access to regular testing in schools, certainly our immediate focus will be on symptomatic individuals. And that's, again, school nurses will have that sort of clinical decision-making and those tools in their hands to address those issues of symptomatic individuals, both students and staff. But the larger question of sort of test on demand, if you will, that's one we're gonna have to work through on supply, and we don't have a settled answer on at the moment. But the surveillance testing, just the application of that relative to its usefulness relative to public health surveillance is going to fade away because it doesn't provide the data in a timely manner that we need to navigate Omicron.
Listeners, we are speaking with Secretary of Education Dan French and the state epidemiologist Patsy Kelso. Now, Patsy Kelso, I want to go back to the point that Jen made, which was about the trust in families and putting the responsibility on families to do this testing and to be honest about it. What incentives do families have to be honest about testing their kids and not sending them to school ill?
Vermonters have largely done the right thing all along. When you look at Vermont's response to the pandemic, whether regardless of what metric you look at, our vaccination rates, our engagement with and trust in the health department, we're at the top of the charts across the country. And of course, not everyone does the right thing all the time. We're still working to educate some Vermonters and parents about the safety and efficacy of vaccines. But, you know, we have to trust each other. And as this virus evolves and becomes endemic and something we learn to live with every year, perhaps in the winter, we're going to need to trust each other to and ourselves to do the right thing and make the right decisions about not going to work or school when you're sick, and letting people know if, you know, you think you're sick, if you expose them and they're particularly vulnerable. It's how we have learned to deal with the flu season every year. You know, you don't go to work or school if you think you have the flu, and that's the way COVID is going to be in the near future.
I'm just wondering, I mean, that's what was pre-pandemic, and now I think we're all exhausted from the pandemic, and parents don't have the luxury that they might have had before to take extra days off to stay with their kids. So I think that the mindset has changed and has evolved, so to speak, with this pandemic. Is that enough? I mean, what you said, I mean, I just don't necessarily think that that's how we are right now.
There are always going to be challenges with available sick leave, paid sick leave, and time off of work, and parents needing to go to work, and the importance of having kids in school as much as possible. I mean, those are not new challenges. We'll have to figure out how we navigate those ongoing challenges in the environment of COVID being just one more thing that we need to think about.
Now, one thing that came up a lot during a conversation that we had in Vermont Edition earlier this week was mental health for students. Secretary French, what are we doing what resources are available to students right now that are really struggling during this pandemic and during these times of COVID learning?
Yeah, these are going to be the big questions, I think, for us as a society, not just in Vermont going forward, as, you know, the cumulative impact of the pandemic on this generation of students. I will say, just by way of an introduction to this topic, you know, one of our primary approaches right now is to keep schools open. And that's one of the best things we can do to ensure students have access to their normal routines and have access to the resources such as mental health and counseling that are largely deployed through the school system. And again, I think it's important that people just really adopt a really flexible attitude in the next couple of weeks, because those systems are going to, as much as we seek to maintain stability, are going to be opening and closing based on largely on staff availability issues. I will say we have considerable dollars earmarked for these investments at the state level to sort of bring an integrated service delivery model to bear on the system. We haven't been able to make that pivot necessarily, largely because of Delta and Omicron now. And, you know, our goal is really to do what we can to keep schools open. really want to emphasize to parents and to certainly the school community that, you know, this is not the time to be worrying about SBAC tests or, you know, staying apace with your normal curriculum and so forth, that, you know, take some of that burden off and just focus on keeping schools open, keeping the routines going for students at this moment. We will have a more direct response planned, an integrated response with our partners at mental health and so forth, once we can get through this sort of immediate moment. But we have some good initiatives in play relative to community schools and educational support teams that we hope to leverage, and we'll have additional resources to start to bring to bear once we can get through this immediate public health moment.
I mean, we talk about wanting to keep schools open, but I mean, even early as this week, we've had schools closed because of COVID and because COVID related issues. What's going to be the latest with that, and how are we as a state going to handle and address keeping schools open where there are massive staffing shortages?
Yeah, and I think this will be the key distinction for this phase compared to what we saw in the fall. It's a lot of the school closure issues are now going to be directly tied to staff availability. And when I say staff availability, I mean people getting sick or having loved ones and their family to take care of and so forth. And, you know, it's to be determined how long this phase will last. Hopefully, you know, as Dr. Kelso referred to, it won't be that long. But we also have some regulatory tools to approach this issue. And I've talked a bit about the waiver process that we have in regulation. So we'll be addressing that issue here from a waiver perspective shortly. But it's not clear yet what the overall pattern will be. But again, you know, the focus, and I think, you know, a large impetus behind us making the shift in policy is to enable more students to stay in school. You know, some of the impact of Omicron that we saw immediately after the holiday, where schools had significant backlogs in contact tracing, and that was resulting in them closing school, essentially, even sort of pre-contact tracing, because they couldn't process the number of students that were involved. Those kinds of practices, you know, just illustrate how inefficient what we were doing was previously. And then once you factor in the idea that it isn't effective from a public health perspective, it just compels us to move forward urgently in a shift in policy.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Waterbury. Kristen, welcome to Vermont Edition. What's your question and or comment?
Thank you for taking my call. So I wanted to better understand what potential accommodations, including medical exemptions, will be made for children and or adults who are unable to get the vaccine and their medical reason falls outside of the very narrow medical exemptions that are currently available.
Let's take that to epidemiologist Patsy Kelso.
I think that always needs to be a discussion between an individual and their healthcare provider about whether there's a medical reason someone cannot get the vaccine. But when we talk about exemptions, that typically applies to a setting where vaccines are mandated, and that is not the case in Vermont.
Let's go to Kimberly in Cornwall. Kimberly, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have just have a quick question about the language that pro-vaxxers, of which I am, is using to try to persuade others. And do you feel like the things like Vermonters are doing the right thing and protecting each other might alienate those who also feel like they're doing the right thing by not vaccinating?
Thanks for that question, Kimberly. Let's take that to, let's go back to epidemiologist Patsy Kelso.
That's a great point. These are certainly individual decisions, and there are probably better ways to talk about people who have chosen to be vaccinated and people who have chosen to not be vaccinated. There are probably better terms that I could be using, and I'm open to being educated on those. The bottom line is that these are very individual decisions that people need to think about their own value set and their own health circumstances and talk to their providers and go from there.
Secretary French, when we had you on Vermont Edition at the beginning of the school year, one of the questions I asked you was, how are we measuring learning loss during the pandemic? And you said that was something that the Agency of Education was working on. I'm wondering what you've learned so far this school year.
Yeah, thanks for the reminder. You know, just to color that in a little bit, the only state level sort of a measure that we have is the SBAC, which is a part of a federal mandatory assessment process. In the data we have from last spring is imperfect at best, in that we had people in all, you know, students in various modes of instruction and so forth, and participation rates in the test were waived, so we didn't necessarily have full participation. What we were hoping to do, I think, when you talked to me last, was we were at that point expecting the school year to unfold more normally. After the initial opening of school, we were hoping to implement a data collection, which would begin to assess not only the academic learning loss, but also the social emotional impact of the pandemic on students. We've held off doing that data collection. It's something we still have ready to go. But Delta basically put that process on the side burner. We've had to be very careful about our data collections with schools due to their limited capacity to respond. But my hope is that we will launch that data collection, which is sort of the precursor to us pivoting into what we call our education recovery work. We're watching Omicron very closely right now. Of course, we're working very hard to implement the new policy. But we would like to really point the system towards that larger recovery work at some point once the cases in Omicron come down and we're able to return to some more operational stability.
That's Secretary of Education Dan French. Secretary French, it's always a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you.
And we also were speaking with state epidemiologist Patsy Kelso. Patsy Kelso, thank you so much for talking to us today.
You're welcome.